and welcome to Travels Through Time. In each episode of this podcast, we invite a special guest to take us on a tailored tour of the past. Travels Through Time is brought to you in partnership with History Today, Britain's best-loved serious history magazine. You can read articles relating to this podcast and more about our guests at historytoday.com/travels. There is also a special subscription offer for Travels Through Time listeners. 3 issues for just £1 each. Hello, I'm Peter Moore, and so far, stowed away in the back of our time machine, we have a collection of Isaac Newton's lectures on planetary motion, a pair of paintings by Joshua Reynolds, a sort of corset harness used by the suffragettes, and an old pub sign for the Pilgrims of the Ocean, which is made from some old ship's timbers. These are all objects we've picked up on our time travels so far, from the years 1684, 1776, 1841, and 1914. All these objects have a story of their own, and if you want to find out more about them, you can browse back through our first 4 episodes. They're all available online. But now it's time for us to clamber once again aboard Time's Winged Chariot in this 5th episode of Travels Through Time, where we invite a special guest to travel to 3 different scenes within the confines of a single calendar year. Today's guest is the writer, lecturer, and most importantly of all, gardener, Matt Biggs. He might be familiar to many of you as a panellist on Radio 4's Gardener's Question Time, where he delivers snippets of horticultural or botanical wisdom on one of the BBC's longest-running programmes. He trained at the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, and I think he will make the perfect time-travelling companion today. Hello, Matt.
Hello there.
We are going to be venturing back to 1905 in pursuit of some plant hunters today. Do you want to tell us just a little bit about plant hunting in the early 20th century?
People have been bringing plants back into Britain and into Europe for centuries, bringing plants back either as herbarium specimens, which were pressed and dried on a sheet of paper and then stored in what's known as a herbarium for scientific use and for identification. They also wanted to bring back plants for gardens. And if you look out into your own garden today, you perhaps don't realise the locations from where your plants originally come from. So lots of them come from China. You'll perhaps recognise Mediterranean plants, definitely from North America, Australia, New Zealand, and they're all gathered together. So in your garden, you've got the whole world and its stories. So plants have been coming back for a long, long time, and they are still coming back. They're still being discovered. Lots of begonias being discovered in the Philippines at the present time. So it remains very, very exciting.
I love this. It's a real twist on the age of exploration to think of these ships coming up the Thames filled with cargoes of plants, which are then in turn going to be reported in the newspapers and going to create a bit of a buzz, and people will be hurrying down to whatever nurseries which kind of neighbour the River Thames to have a look at them and maybe purchase them and possess them and grow them themselves in a new way.
It's not the kind of thing we would sit comfortably with us today, that you would go out and gather plants from the wild in great numbers as they often did. But what it has done, quite interestingly, is there are plants today which are endangered in the wild in their native habitats, but we grow them in gardens. So for example, at the Eden Project, they still have some plants from the original collections of the monkey puzzle tree. Those genotypes have been able to be taken back to where they were originally collected from in Chile. It's not just the species, the Araucaria araucana, the monkey puzzle tree, but the correct genotype as well, because they've been grown in British gardens and their offspring have too.
You're going to tell us about one of the greatest of all the plant hunters. Go on, tell us who this is.
George Forrest, a Dour Scotsman, who not only brought back amazing numbers of plants, primarily primulas, rhododendrons, and a lot of the garden plants that we grow today, a lot of the camellias were bred from plants that he brought back. He brought back some wonderful magnolias. And of course, you have to remember at this time, if you were an industrialist or an aristocrat with an estate, in those days, you wouldn't have a super yacht and a football club. You would have a zebra, some amazing plants that had just been bought in that nobody else had got, and were planting up your estate with these you know, grand and wonderful plants.
George Forrest, it's the 4th of July in 1905. Can you tell us where George Forrest is on this date?
Yes, he's in a little mission station in a town called in a place called Seku in Yunnan. He was a very tough character. I just imagine this sort of what rather a very self-assured man, because you read that he was very self-assured. But the one thing about him was that he loved the outdoor life. Mm. So he loved it tough.
And where are we now then? If we were looking at him on this day, whereabouts are we?
So he's actually sort of out in the mountains. So he's out in the high mountains. And
this is in Tibet.
In Tibet. So up towards Tibet and Sichuan. And it's the Yangtze-Salween-Mekong divide. Now that's the area where he collected. He spent a lot of time in Yunnan, but did sort of make forays into Burma and southeast Tibet.
So you mentioned before the number of plants he brought back. A lot of them came from this area.
So a lot of them would come from this area. And it was quite interesting for him because he could collect herbaceous plants in the plains and rhododendrons on the mountain tops and on the hillsides. He could collect shrubs. So there was a wide range of plants for him to bring back, and quite a lot of alpine plants too. One of his most famous ones is something called Gentiana sino-ornata, the ornate Chinese gentian. And it's a low grow, very creeping plant, autumn flowering, but it has the most extraordinary Asia blue flower. The flower colour is incredible.
So if we imagine him there on this day, he is someone very highly attuned to his environment. He's always on the lookout for something that might be of interest that he could take home with him. And I suppose at this point he's about to set off on a big expedition, is that right?
Yes, he was an interesting chap because he's, you know, you've got this stocky individual, and you look back, you know, people, when they fill in a careers form these days, and in those days you wouldn't put down plant collector. So it was one of those jobs that he sort of fell into. He loved the outdoors, he loved his shooting, he loved his fishing. He had also interestingly worked for a short time in a pharmacist where he was preparing medicines, getting close to plants, of course, because it was plant-based medicine, learned some sort of rudimentary medical practices, because later on in his career he actually had lymph sent out and inoculated a lot of the Chinese where in the area he was working, giving something back to the community. He inoculated them against smallpox. So he got this background with plants.
So a robust character.
Very, 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 very tough and very determined.
Because he's about to head into quite a forbidding landscape environment, isn't he?
To be out in Sichuan, you know, high in the mountains, wreathed in snow. And he said that it reminded him of his home, you know, when he was walking in the fells in Scotland. So I think he'd got an affinity.
So should we imagine him working on his own, or would he be accompanied by a party of other people as well?
Because of the nature of where he worked, he trained local people from the Lisu tribe mainly to work with him, and he had upward of, you know, 30 collectors. So because this area where he was between the river valleys and sort of up near Tibet, if you imagine sort of V-shaped mountains, it's almost like, you know, like Toblerone, you know, you've got those real peaks and troughs. Yeah, so yeah, the top was alpine, you know, the bottom was youthful river valleys. The area that he actually covered from Sichuan and his forays into Tibet and Burma, 50,000 square miles. That was his manor.
Yeah.
Okay, and he jealously guarded it. So he trained local collectors, and he was very good with them. He was very accomplished at training them. And when he died, indeed, they went off and collected the plants that they'd noted and listed to collect the following year. So he had a headman called Chow, and the indigenous people who worked for him were very devoted to him. He was devoted to them, but he couldn't have collected without them. Obviously, historically, when we read the books and read the literature and the articles, they don't get much of a mention.
I think that's a really important point.
But it is,
so, of course, we remember the plant hunter, but he was supported by this apparatus of local people, indigenous people who aided him in all sorts of different ways. And we can imagine them on this date, which is, as we say before, the 4th of July 1905, about to head off on another of the big expeditions. So we'll leave that there. We've looked down from our time machine, and I want to go from that scene, which I suppose is full of hope and excitement, it's the beginning of a new project, to something which is just a fortnight later, on the 19th of July, 1905, when things start to go a little bit awry. Do you want to tell us what happens on the 19th of July, 1905, with Forrest?
On this particular date, things changed dramatically, because what had happened was the British had invaded Tibet, almost effectively annexed it, because they were worried about the Russians moving in. Francis' young husband had gone in there, into Lhasa, and just upset the Tibetan Lamas. They were concerned about losing what was they regarded as their space to enemy invaders. They wanted vengeance, and they were killing Europeans, they were killing Chinese. And we tend to think of Buddhism as a passive, gentle religion. On that date, they were not.
So we can imagine, right through the middle of this completely conflicted scene, we have Mr. Forrest, the plant tender, trotting along, accompanied by his, I suppose, his company of helpers and such like, and fixers. And what happened?
They received a message that the nearby town had been sacked and burned, and the reaction would have been to gather everything up and run. And they were aiming for a village about 30 miles away, which, again, think about the landscape, very, very difficult, yeah. Very tough. 30 miles is quite a distance
it's
anyway.
It's still quite a distance, but in that terrain...
It was difficult. There were two priests, you know, they said, you know, we will fight for Christianity. They were waiting when really they should have been running. So they gathered the group together, and finally... You know, Forrest was able to gee them up. And I could imagine a group of 80 people and one man trying to get them all motivated with the two priests saying, oh no, we're going to stay and fight. And they eventually, by the light of a full moon, you can imagine the shadows being cast across the valley. They tiptoed out along narrow paths that were only some 2 foot in places. And initially, they managed to make headway. But then they were going by a village, but somebody made a noise. And they heard it. You can imagine the silence of the mountains out there, real silence. Just a footfall, just a stone rolling down the side
and
of
the suspense is broken.
And then suddenly a shout went out, a whistle went out, and they had been heard.
And these are the events of the 19th, is that right?
Yes.
So if we're there watching on, you'd be looking over this scene, which is full of dramatic tension.
So frightening, because everything was tense. You know, they were being pursued by bloodthirsty llamas who, no doubt about it, they wanted to hack them to pieces. You've got a group of 80 people that you're trying to manoeuvre along a narrow path with a flooded river, you know, glacial meltwater rushing down. They were trapped.
And do we know what happened then? So what happens next?
Well, over a process of time, it was quite interesting, because the two priests wanted, at one point, they wanted to stop for tiffin, for something to eat. Then they did go to another place.
Is tiffin that very sugary thing that they give you when you go up into the mountains?
Yes, it is. Yeah. They were elderly. You have to give them that. So they probably wanted a rest. That was the truth. But of course, Forrest didn't have a lot of truck with that, because he knew that they got to get out. They eventually escaped, and then they stopped for tiffin again. And Forrest writes, he said, understandably, he didn't feel hungry. They'd not eaten for a long time, but didn't feel hungry. And he's decided to go ahead to a promontory and look. And he looked back, and there he saw about 20 to 30 Tibetans. He described it in Indian file, you know, so running along this sort of narrow pathway.
And this is the same route that they had passed a few hours earlier.
Yes, so some of the backmarkers got there first, told them. It was one of those things where, you know, they're after us, they're coming. Yeah. You know, a second later, Forrest looks and he sees heavily armed people pursuing his little group. Well, you can imagine, they fell among the group, they slaughtered them, you know, with their big two-handed swords, and only one of his fellow plant hunters collectors survived. Now, Forrest was that little bit ahead. He realised that what was likely to have happened was that when they made the noise going by the village, they would have sent a group out to go and cut them off. And Forrest decided to go another way. He chose a different route, and he was running, and he describes that he didn't know how he survived, because there was narrow paths, and sometimes these paths were actually just logs that were supported by brackets held in the cliff face. They were so narrow, they were wet from the constant moisture of the river, you know, the spray. He came to a corner, and as he went round the sharp corner, there in front of him were the llamas. And so what he did was, he suddenly thought, you know, he realised that he couldn't do anything. He ran back and retraced his spot. And once he got round that little sharp corner where he was out of sight for a moment, he jumped off the cliff and rolled down. And he describes how he rolled down through the jungle and the vegetation. And then when he stopped after about 200 feet, He said he was bruised all over, his clothes were ripped and torn, but it was silent. One of the letters that I really love is a letter from Isaac Bailey Balfour, who was the head of the herbarium at Edinburgh, to A.K. Bully, who had employed Forrest to go out to collect plants. "Dear Mr. Bully, you will doubtless have heard through the Foreign Office from Mr. Lytton that there is little doubt that Forrest has been murdered. His last letter to me, written at Sekou on the 27th of May, told of the troubles around him, of the murder of the French missionaries, and the scarcity of food. But though anxious, he seemed to be confident that he would come through all right. The date of the murder, 21st of July, given by the Foreign Office, shows that for about 2 months after his letter, no crisis had come. He was not a man to yield. He would die fighting, as I sincerely hope he did. You will be, as we are all here, deeply grieved by the catastrophe. He seemed to be showing himself a born collector. The dried plants he sent home were in perfect condition, and I gather that you were pleased with the seeds that reached you from him. It was unlucky that he should go up to Sekou again just at the moment when the disturbances broke out, for apparently that is a centre of wealth of new vegetation. I do hope that it may be some recompense for you for your enterprises in sending him out there. Miss Traill, his fiancée, to whom I had to break the news this morning, is naturally much upset. We shall, I hope, learn details later from Mr. Lytton, and I trust something may come out of this inquiry. We have lost a really good man from whom we had looked for great horticultural prizes. Yours very truly, Isaac Bailey Balfour." And it's dated the 17th of August, 1905.
I think that's a perfect place to leave him in this great moment of peril in the mountains, having tumbled over the side of the precipice down to the bottom. And I'm going to get you to fill in the story in a minute, because we're going to go from there to our third scene, which is a little bit later, when a strange character dressed as in Tibetan clothes manages to find safety in a local village. What had been happening? Is this Forrest?
Amazingly, it is. In fact, what's remarkable, of course, because he was dressed as a Tibetan trying to escape, when he arrived at the place of safety, one of the priests who happened, very fortuitously, to be away from the mission when it was attacked, was across the river. Forrest could recognise him, but of course he couldn't recognise Forrest.
So would this be half of the charm of seeing him arrive back to safety? You know, this idea of someone completely altered physically, who's been through this massive ordeal, but is still, in a way, still going with his ideals of collecting.
Peter, this chap, he'd come back from the dead. You imagine the emotional roller coaster.
It's almost like a resurrection scene,
yeah.
Isn't it?
I mean, it must have been quite comical in a way, because somebody who you thought was dead turns up dressed as a Tibetan. And so I would guess it wasn't until he got very close, or they heard his voice, probably heard his voice, they realised with his Scots accent. To be able to go through it today, and like you say, you almost be in the time machine looking at what's happening and just imagining people's reactions. Brilliant. So exciting.
And how far away is this village from where we left him on the precipice?
They got about 30 miles. There was still a long way for Forrest to go.
So as you said before, 30 miles in the mountains is not 30 miles on the flats. How did Forrest, the plant hunter, manage to survive in this interim, which I suppose is... We've got probably 10 days difference, have we not?
Say about 8 or 9 days, he was hunted. So he would sleep during the day, you know, sometimes under a rock, another time under a bridge, but out of the way. And then during the night time, try and make his escape. So on the first night, he decided to climb back up where he'd come from and to go to about another 5,000 feet up to a ridge and escape along a ridge and out. And he describes how he had to move really sort of gingerly, really carefully, because, again, this fear of making a noise. We all know how noise is magnified, you know, in silence in the mountains as well. You know, even the tiniest stone being kicked. So he started to climb up. And when he got to the top of the ridge, he said he could see right out into the distance, almost equidistant fires with people by them. Basically, they were guarding the ridge. There was no way he was going to escape. They obviously realised you don't go the easy route, you take the hard route. And Special Forces soldiers still do that, don't they? They don't go along the main street. They walk along the rooftops. So that's what he tried to do. And he was quite crestfallen. And he decided then to climb back down. So that journey took him the whole of that night. So he tried a similar thing again, and still the same problem. And he realised that they were able to track him because of his boots. So he took his boots off and he buried them in the stream. And then another of the knights, he decided to wade about a mile upriver, waist deep, glacial water.
Good advert for Scottish hardihood, isn't it?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, what a hero. Yeah. You know, that is tough.
And should we imagine him holding any plants at this point, or have they all been jettisoned?
Sadly, he lost everything. Collectors took some of his plants. He gave them money. He gave them silver to take his plants in the hope that they would carry it and get to safety. Mm. But of course, once the attack happened...
But he was still thinking about trying to get his plants.
Still thinking his plants. One time he was asleep under a bridge, and about 30 feet away, he heard voices. That was a group of Tibetans. Another time he was nearly caught by a lady who had been sent out to track him. So there were several near squeaks just with him sort of staying still, hiding low and getting lucky. He then decides to give himself up. And he said, I must have presented a dreadful sight. He said, caked in mud, unkempt, unshaven, clothes torn, feet swollen. He decided that he would go to a little group of houses, a little hamlet, and give himself up. And, you know, you need a bit of luck to survive as well as fortitude. And he knocked on the door and he'd had nothing to eat apart from just a few grains of wheat and some peas that he'd picked up. He was able to say sampa, which is the ground maize meal, and then just collapsed. And, you know, he collapsed into a friendly hut, if you like, because the people there were friendly.
They
engineered his escape. He still had another journey of several days. Again, he describes almost unmitigating misery, because what he had to do was he was given guides, but they had to go again right high over the mountaintops, 19,000 feet through snowfields. He said his feet were cut by the limestone landscape that he was going through. At one point, he describes fields of rhododendrons, saxifrages, gentians, all these poppies, all these wonderful plants. And he said he picked a few and popped them in his notebook. But the lovely thing about him is that he said in his letter, he says, all being well, I will come back next year and collect. Isn't that wonderful?
So that little candle which is burning inside him never quite goes out despite everything. But it must have been like the story of Tantalus, really, walking among all these fields of poppies and rhododendrons and all sorts, not being able to lay his hands on any of them. And I think as well, what we've got here is the thing that always draws me to the story of the plant hunters is we can just glance out into the garden now, into these plants which are all sitting there, and they seem quite sedate and quiet, but in a way they're all concealing these quite extraordinary histories, often really familiar plants, as well as that excitement of the discovery process in the first place. And you've got a wonderful story, haven't you, about one of his rhododendron coming back to Scotland and flowering for the first time.
You have to understand that if you were into plants, that this was a really, really exciting time. It was a time that I certainly would have loved to have been in. Forest Seeds went back to his sponsors. And one of the rhododendrons, called Rhododendron Sino Grande, the grand Chinese rhododendron. It has beautiful, almost like airship-shaped leaves that can get to be about 15, 20 inches long. On that, they have a lovely buster of sort of creamy white flowers. One of the first places that it flowered was a garden called Arisaig up near Inverness. And the owner, Mr. Holmes, decided to bring the flower down to Edinburgh Botanical Gardens. Caught his train down to Edinburgh, got off at Princess Street Station, and he walked with this rhododendron. It's not the kind of thing you can put in a bag or in a box. And he walked with it above his head like an umbrella. And by the time he got to the gates of the Botanic Gardens, he was mobbed.
Oh, wow.
He was mobbed.
So this is the height of fashion. He's got the Sino Grande. He's like the iPhone 10 Plus or whatever it is of the day.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And it all comes back, really, doesn't it, to these moments of collection halfway around the world. So we're connecting these two stories, like this is refined Prince's Street, but here is the amazingly contentious space high in the Himalayan foothills or whatever. So
it is interesting, though. It connects our gardens with the outside world, and the whole world is in your garden, and that's what makes it exciting. So your plant collecting expedition might be to the local garden centre, but a lot of the plants from there have originated somewhere in the wild, even if they've ended up being bred. And that's why the garden, historically and scientifically, with all the plants and the stories that go with it, to me, is one of the most exciting places in the world.
Well, I think that's a wonderful time travel, because what we've got is Forrest about to start off on his exhibition. We've got this moment of incredible drama when they have the confrontation on the rock face by the precipice, and then you've got him really coming back from the dead, and all of this is in the pursuit of plants, really. And I think that's a wonderful idea. You've given us a really, really good overview of that. We've got a few pieces of supplementary business, though, I want to ask you about before we finish. The first one is, if you could bring one object back from 1905 to 2019, what would you like to bring with you?
With Forrest, I would say one thing that he did was that he took a lot of photographs. There's a lot of photographs in the archives at the Botanical Gardens in Edinburgh. So I would like his camera.
I would love
his camera, because you could, again, not only were his helpers lugging plants, but also carrying his camera so he could take his photographs. And I think, but this was a prop.
Is this one of the large format ones that we can imagine when you have to disappear inside? And...
It wasn't quite that, but it was getting on that way. I'm not a sort of camera technician, but I've seen a picture of it, and it's a sort of large, almost sort of box camera, in metal, so it's heavy, robust, of course, because it's got to survive.
Brilliant.
But the idea of having...
Camera that Forrest used.
Yeah, basically. And I could have that on my mantelpiece, and every time I'd sit there and watch that rather than watch the telly.
Oh, brilliant. Well, that's really good. And last thing, really, is to ask you about your book, which is all about the history of plant hunters. And this is not just Forrest, there's a whole massive history, and you've written about that. So can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it was a book for the Royal Horticultural Society called Secrets of Great Botanists. So I started with Theophrastus right to the present day. And there are a couple of present day plant collectors in there that I felt...
Theophrastus who collected frankincense and things like that?
Yes, the very man. We've got field botanists, we've got ethnobotanists, we've got a wonderful man called Richard Evans Schultes, who collected in the Amazon, and he lived with the indigenous peoples. So when you see him at work at Harvard, he's in a suit, short cropped hair, you know, wire spectacles, tall, upstanding man in a tie. And then you find another picture of him, sort of almost in a grass skirt with a mask on and living with the people. And it's really incongruous. And it's great fun. A botanist who's the assistant to Philibert Commerson, the circumnavigation of the globe with Bougainville and the Bougainvillea, which is a famous exotic.
And this is a part of the strange afterlife that a lot of these botanists have, because they survive in the names of plants often.
Yeah.
Banksia is another one which has come from
And they
Joseph
do.
Banks.
And there's lots of... And there are lots of, you know, the Sorbus forestii, you know, there are forest plants. The interesting thing, by the way, about Philibert Commerson was that his wife died. His cleaner became his lover. When he got the gig of being the botanist on Bougainville's journey, he didn't want to leave his love behind. So she was dressed up as a boy and got round to Tahiti before she was discovered.
Well, there we go. These botanists, they're full of stories. And I think, right through your writings, you treat us to all sorts of wonderful stories from the past. I think that's all we've got time for today. But Matt Biggs, this has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today and to hear a little bit about Mr. Forrest. So we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
I'm Paul Lay, the editor of History Today. On our website, you'll find articles written by experts relating to Matt Biggs' troubles. You can read William Seymour on George Forrest's explorations of two continents, Wilfred Blunt on native and invasive plants, while Tom Griffiths looks deep into the environmental history of Australia. Links to all of these pieces can be found at historytoday.com/travels. And there are many more articles on every aspect of the past in our monthly publication, History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine.